the pair of a tie bond. It was something there were no words for in mundane English. He was meant to want Emma's happiness more than he wanted his own, and he did. He did. So why did he feel like he was being stabbed to death from the inside? He fumbled for the gold paint, because the longing was rising up in him, beating in his veins, and only painting her would take it away. And he couldn't paint her without gold. He caught up the tube and choked. The brush rattled from his hand onto the ground, and he crumpled to his knees. He was gasping, his chest spasming. He couldn't drag air into his lungs. His eyes burned, and the back of his throat burned, too. Salt. He was choking on salt. Not the salt of blood, but the salt of the ocean. He tasted the sea in his mouth and coughed, his body clenching as he spat up seawater onto the floor. Seawater. He wiped the back of his hand across his mouth, his heart pounding. He'd gone nowhere near the ocean today, and yet he could hear it in his ears, as if he were listening to a seashell. His body ached and his parabatai rune throbbed. Shocked and dizzy, he placed his hand over the rune, and he knew. He knew without knowing how he knew. Knew it down in his soul where his connection to Emma had been forged in blood and fire. He knew in the way that she was part of him, the way her breathing was his breathing, and her dreams were his dreams, and her blood was his blood. And when her heart stopped, he knew that his would too, and he would be glad, because he didn't want to live one second in a world that didn't have her in it. He closed his eyes and saw the ocean rise up behind his eyelids, blue-black and depthless, charged with the force of the first wave that had ever crashed on the first lonely beach, and he knew. "Whither thou goest, I will go." "Emma," he whispered and took off at a run. Emma was not sure what terrified her most about the ocean. There was the rage of the waves, dark blue and tipped with white like lace. They were deceptively beautiful, but as they neared the shore, they closed in like fists. She had been trapped by a breaking wave once, and she remembered the feeling of falling, as if she were plunging down an elevator shaft, and then the force of the water pinning her to the sand. She had choked and struggled, trying to free herself, to push her way back up to the air. There was also the depth of it. She had read before about people who had been abandoned out to sea, how they had gone insane thinking about what was below them, the miles and miles of water and the dark and toothy and slippery things that lived in it. As she was slammed through the porthole door and into the ocean, salt water swallowed Emma, filled her eyes and ears. She was surrounded by water, blackness opening up below her like a pit. She could see the pale square of the porthole door receding in the distance, but try as she might, she couldn't kick her way toward it. The current was too strong. Hopelessly, she looked up. Her witchlight stone was gone, sinking through the water below her. The light from the ever-receding porthole lit the area around her, but she could see nothing but darkness above. Her ears were popping. Raziel only knew how deep down she was. The water near the porthole was pale green, the color of jade, but everywhere else it was black as death. She reached for a steely. Her lungs were already aching. Floating in the water, kicking out against the current, she jammed the tip of the steely against her arm and scrawled a breathing rune. The ache in her lungs eased. With the pain gone, the fear came crashing in, blinding in its intensity. The breathing rune kept her from struggling for air, but the horror of what might be around her was nearly as intense. She reached for the seraph blade in her belt and pulled it free. "Manukel," she thought. The blade came to life in her hands, spilling out light, and the water around her turned to murky gold. For a moment Emma was dazzled. Then her vision cleared and she saw them. Demons. She screamed, and the bubbles rose up around her, silent. They were below her, like nightmares rising, lumpy, slippery creatures. Waving tentacles crowned with jagged teeth flailed toward her. She swung Manukel and severed the spiked limb reaching for her leg. Black blood exploded into the water, billowing up in clouds. A scarlet snake-like thing shot toward her through the water. She kicked out, collided with something fleshy and soft. She gagged on revulsion and stabbed downward. More blood spilled. The sea around her was turning to charcoal. She kicked up toward the surface, carried on a billow of demon blood. As she rose, she could see the white moon, a blurred pearl on the surface of the water. The breathing rune had burned off her skin. Her lungs felt as if they were collapsing. She could feel the churn of water under her feet, didn't dare to look down. She reached up, up toward where the water ended, felt her hand break the surface, the chill of air on her fingers. Something caught at her wrist. Her serif blade fell from her hand, a glowing point of light that tumbled away from her as she was hauled to the surface of the water. She gasped in air, but it was too soon. Water filled her lungs, her chest, and darkness slammed into her with the force of a truck. Idris, 2009. It was at Emma and Julian's Parabatai ceremony that she had learned two important things. The first was that she wasn't the only Carstairs left in the world. Their Parabatai ceremony was performed in Idris, because he had fought in the Dark War and their valor was recognized. At least, Julian said, it was recognized sometimes, not when they really wanted anything important like his sister back from Wrangel Island, but when the Nephilim felt like throwing a party about how awesome Nephilim were, it was always a feature. When they arrived, they looked around the streets of Alicante astonished. The last time they had been in the capital city of Idris, it had been wrecked by the Dark War. The streets torn up, nails hammered into walls to keep out fairies, the doors of the Accords Hall torn away. Now it was pristine again, the cobblestones back in place, the canals winding by the houses and the demon towers glimmering over it all. "It seems smaller," Julian said, looking around from the Accords Hall steps. "It's not that it's smaller." The voice belonged to a young man with dark hair and dark eyes, smiling down at them. "It's that you've grown." They stared at him. "Don't you remember me?" he said. He lowered his voice as if he were quoting, "Emma Cordelia Carstairs. Stay with your Parabatai. Sometimes it's braver not to fight. Protect them and save your vengeance for another day." "Brother Zachariah?" Emma was astonished. "You helped us during the Dark War." "I am no longer a silent brother," he said. "Only an ordinary man. My name is James. James Carstairs. But everyone calls me Jem." There was astonishment, and there was chatter, and Julian gave Emma space to be shocked and to pepper former brother Zachariah with questions. Jem explained that he had become a silent brother in 1878, but he had shed the role now so that he could marry the woman he loved, the warlock Tessa Gray. Julian asked if that meant he was 150 years old, and Jem admitted that he nearly was, though he didn't look it. He looked about 23. "Why didn't you tell me back then?" Emma demanded as they wended their way into the silent city, down long stone staircases, "that you were a Carstairs." "I thought I might die," he said candidly. "It was a battle. It seemed a cruel thing to tell you if I wasn't going to live through the day. And after that, Tessa cautioned me that I should give you time to grieve your parents, to adjust to your new life." He turned and looked at her, and his expression was both sorrowful and affectionate. "You're a shadow hunter, Emma, and neither Tessa nor I are Nephilim, not anymore. To come and live with me, though you would be welcome, we'd have to give up being a shadow hunter, and that was too cruel a choice to place in front of you." "Come live with you?" It was Julian, a warning sharp in his tone. "Why would she do that? She has a home. She has a family." "Exactly," Jem said. "And there is more. Can you give me a moment alone with Emma?" Julian checked in with Emma with his eyes, and she nodded. He turned and made his way down the stairs, glancing back several times to make sure she was all right. Jem touched her arm with light fingers. She was wearing ceremonial gear, ready for the ritual, but she could feel the scar she had given herself with Cortana flare when he touched her, as if recognizing their shared blood. "I wanted to be here for you, for this," he said, "for I had a Parabatai myself once, and the bond of it is precious to me." Emma didn't ask what had happened to Jem's Parabatai. Silent brothers were forbidden from having Parabatai, and besides, 130 years was a long, long time. "But I don't know when I can be with you again," he said. "Tessa and I, we have to find something, something important." He hesitated. "It will be dangerous looking for it, but once it's found, I'd like to be part of your life once more. Like a sort of uncle." He gave a half smile. "You might not guess it, but I have a lot of experience in being an uncle." His gaze was steady on hers, and though there was no physical resemblance between them, for that moment Emma was reminded of her father, of his level gaze and kind face. "I'd like that," she said. "Can I ask you one more thing?" He nodded, his expression serious. It was easy to imagine him as an uncle. He looked so young. But there was a calm certainty underneath that made him seem ageless, like a fairy or a warlock. Yes? Did you send me your cat? Church? He started to laugh. Yes. Has he been taking care of you? Did he bring you the gifts I gave? The shells and sea glass? She nodded. The bracelet Julian's wearing is made out of sea glass Church brought me. His laughter softened into a smile that was a little bit sad. As it should be, he said. What belongs to one Parabatai belongs to the other. For you are one heart now, and one soul. Jem stayed with Emma through the ceremony, which was witnessed by Simon and Clary, whom she suspected would become Parabatai themselves one day. After the ceremony, Julian and Emma were led through the streets to the Accords Hall, where there was a special dinner in their honor. Tessa, a pretty brown-haired girl who looked about Clary's age, had joined them, hugging Emma tightly and exclaiming over Cortana, which she said she had seen before a long time ago. Other Parabatai got up and spoke about their bond and their experiences. Waves of radiant happiness seemed to come off the pairs of best friends as they talked. Jason and Alec spoke about nearly dying in the demon realms together, grinning, and Emma felt a sense of joy at the thought that one day she and Jules would be up there, smiling dopily at each other and talking about how their bond had gotten them through times when they thought they were going to die. At some point during the speeches, Jem had slipped quietly from his chair and disappeared through the doors to Angel Square. Tessa had dropped her napkin and hurried after him. As the doors closed, Emma could see them on the dimly lit steps. Jem had his head down on Tessa's shoulder. She wanted to go after them, but she was already being swept up to the front of the hall by Clary and made to give some sort of speech, and Julian was with her, smiling that calm smile that hid a million thoughts. And Emma had been happy. She had been wearing one of her first gray thrift store finds, a real gown, not like the ragged jeans she usually wore until they fell to pieces. Instead, she'd put on a brown paraphernalia dress scattered with pale gold blossoms like sunflowers growing out of a field, and let her hair, which reached her waist, out of its usual ponytail. She'd shot up like a weed in the past year, and she nearly reached Jace's shoulder when he came over to congratulate her and Julian. She'd had the worst crush of all time on Jace when she was 12, and she still felt a little awkward around him. He was nearly 19 years old now, and even better looking than he had been, taller, broader, tanned, and with his hair bleached from sunlight, but more than anything else, happier looking. She remembered a tense-looking beautiful boy who burned with revenge and heavenly fire, and now he looked at ease with himself. Which was nice. She was happy for him and for Clary, who smiled and waved at her across the room. But she no longer got butterflies in her stomach when he smiled at her, or wanted to crawl under something and die when he hugged her and told her she looked pretty in her new dress. "You've got a lot of responsibility now," he said to Julian. "You'll have to make sure she winds up with a guy who deserves her." Julian was strangely white-faced. Maybe he was feeling the effects of the ceremony, Emma thought. It had been strong magic, and she still felt it sizzling through her blood like champagne bubbles. But Jules looked as if he were getting sick. "What about me?" Emma said quickly. "Don't I have to make sure Jules winds up with someone who deserves him?"
"Absolutely. I did it for Alec. Alec did it for me. Well, actually, he hated Clary at first, but he came around."
"I bet you didn't like Magnus much either," said Julian, still with the same odd, stiff look on his face.
"Maybe not," said Jace. "But I never would have said so."
"Because it would have hurt Alec's feelings?" Emma asked.
"No," said Jace. "Because Magnus would have turned me into a hat rack." And he wandered back toward Clary, who was laughing with Alec, both of them looking happy.
Which was as it should be, Emma thought. Once Parabatai should be friends with the person you loved, your spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend, because that was how it worked. Though when she tried to imagine the person she'd be with, someone she might marry and stay with forever, there was only a sort of blurry space. She couldn't picture the person at all.
"I have to go," Julian said. "I need some air."
He brushed the back of his hand across Emma's cheek before making for the double doors of the hall. It was a ragged touch. His nails were bitten down to the edges. Later that night, Emma woke up from a dream of fiery circles, her skin burning hot, the sheets tangled around her legs. They had been put up in the old Blackthorn Manor house, and Julian was far away, down corridors she didn't know like she knew the hallways of the Institute. She went to the window.
It was a short drop down to the garden path. She kicked her feet into slippers and climbed outside. The path curved around the gardens. Emma made her way along it, breathing in the cool, clean air of Idris, untouched by smog. The sky above was brilliant with a million stars, totally free of light pollution, and she wished Julian was with her so she could show it to him. And then she heard voices. The Blackthorn Manor had burned down quite a long time ago and had been rebuilt near to the Herondale Manor. Emma wandered down a number of pretty paths until she found a wall. There was a gate set into the wall. As Emma approached it, she could hear the murmured voices more clearly. She crept to the side of the gate and peered through the bars. On the other side, a green lawn sloped down to the Herondale Manor, a pile of white and tawny stone. The grass was sparkling with dew under the starlight and starred with white flowers that grew only in Idris.
"And that constellation right there? That's the rabbit. See how it has ears?"
It was Jace's voice. He and Claria were sitting in the grass, shoulder to shoulder. He was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, and Claria was in her nightgown, Jace's jacket around her shoulders. Jace was pointing at the sky.
"I'm pretty sure there's no rabbit constellation," Clary said.
She hadn't changed as much as Jace had in the past years. She was still slight, her red hair bright as Christmas, her small face freckled and thoughtful. She had her head against Jace's shoulder.
"Sure there is," he said, and as the starlight touched his pale curls, Emma felt a faint flutter of her old crush. "And that one there, that's the hubcap. And there's the great pancake."
"I'm going back inside," Clary said. "I was promised an astronomy lesson."
"What? Sailors used to navigate by the great pancake," said Jace, and Clary shook her head and started to stand up.
Jace grabbed her ankle and she laughed and tumbled over on top of him. And then they were kissing, and Emma froze, because what had been a casual moment, one she could have interrupted with a friendly hello, had suddenly become something else. Jace rolled over on top of Clary in the grass. She had her arms wrapped around him, her hands in his hair. His jacket had fallen off her shoulders, and the straps of her nightgown were sliding down her pale arms. Clary was laughing and saying his name, saying maybe they should go back inside, and Jace kissed her neck. Clary gasped, and Emma heard him say, "Remember the Wayland Manor? Remember that time outside?"
"I remember." Her voice was low and throaty.
"I didn't think I could have you," Jace said. He was propped over Clary on his elbows, tracing the line of her cheek with his finger. "It was like being in hell. I would have done anything for you. I still would." Clary flattened her hand against his chest, over his heart, and said, "I love you."
He made a noise, a very un-Jace-like noise, and Emma jerked herself away from the gate and ran back toward the Blackthorn house.
She reached her window and climbed up inside, gasping. The moon shone down like a floodlight, illuminating her room. She kicked off her slippers and sat down on the bed. Her heart was hammering inside her chest. The way Jace had looked down at Clary, the way she touched his face. She wondered if anyone would ever look at her like that. It didn't seem possible. She couldn't imagine loving anyone that much. Anyone but Jules. But that was different, wasn't it? She couldn't imagine Julian lying on top of her, kissing her like that. They were different. They were something else, weren't they? She lay back down on the bed, looking across the room at the door. Some part of her expected Jules to come through it, to come to her because she was unhappy the way he often did, seeming to know without being told. But why would he think she was unhappy? Today had been her parabatai ceremony. It should have been one of the happiest days of her life, except for maybe her wedding day. Instead, she felt flushed and strange, and full of the strangest urge to cry. "Jules," she thought. But the door didn't open, and he didn't come. Instead, she curled up around her pillow and lay awake until dawn.
18. All the Night Tide. After the darkness, there was light. Bright white and silver, starlight on water and sand. And Emma was flying. Over the surface of the water, now shallow, she could see the sand of the beach underneath, and a pool of fire where the moon reflected. There was a pain in her chest. She twisted to get away from it and realized she wasn't flying. She was being carried. She was being held against a hard chest and arms were around her. She saw the glimmer of blue-green eyes. Julian. Julian was carrying her. Wet, dark curls crowned his head. She tried to draw in a breath to speak, and choked. Her chest spasmed. Water filled her mouth, bitter and salty like blood. She saw Julian's face twist with panic, and then he was half running up the beach, finally crashing to his knees, depositing her in the sand. She was still coughing, choking, looking up at him with frightened eyes. She saw the same fear mirrored on his face. She wanted to tell him it would be all right, everything was going to be fine, but she couldn't speak past the water in her throat. He fumbled a steely from his belt, and she felt the tip burn against her skin. Her head fell back as the rune formed. She saw the moon over her, behind Julian's head like a halo. She wanted to tell him he had a halo. Maybe he'd think it was funny. But the words were drowning in her chest. She was drowning, dying on land. The rune was finished. Julian pulled the steely back and Emma's chest seemed to cave in. She cried out and water exploded from her lungs. She curled up, racked with deep coughs. It hurt as her body expelled the seawater, as if she were being turned inside out. She felt Julian's hand on her back, his fingers between her shoulder blades holding her steady. At last the coughing slowed. She rolled onto her back and stared up at Julian and the sky behind him. She could see a million stars, and he still had his halo, but there was no longer anything funny about it. He was shivering, his black shirt and jeans plastered to his body, his face whiter than the moon. "Emma," he whispered.
"Jules," she said.
Her voice sounded weak and rough to her own ears.
I'm all right."
"What the hell happened? What were you doing in the water?"
"I went to the convergence," she whispered. "There was some kind of spell. It sucked me out into the ocean."
"You went to the convergence by yourself?" His voice rose. "How could you be so reckless?"
"I had to try."
"You didn't have to try alone." His voice seemed to echo off the water. His fists were clenched at his sides. She realized he wasn't shaking from cold after all. It was rage. "What the hell is the point of being parabatai if you go off and risk yourself without me?"
"I didn't want to put you in danger.
I almost drowned inside the Institute. I coughed up water. Water you breathed." Emma stared at him in shock. She started to prop herself up on her elbows. Her hair, heavy and soaked, hung down her back like a weight.
"How is that possible?"
"Of course it's possible." His voice seemed to explode out of his body. "We are bound together, Emma. Bound together. I breathe when you breathe. I bleed when you bleed. I'm yours and you're mine. You've always been mine, and I have always, always belonged to you." She had never heard him say anything like this, never heard him talk this way, never seen him so close to losing control.
"I didn't mean to hurt you," she said.
She started to sit up, reaching for him. He caught her wrist. "Are you joking?" Even in the darkness, his blue-green eyes had color. "Is this a joke to you, Emma? Don't you understand?" His voice dropped to a whisper.
"I don't live if you die."
Her eyes searched his face.
"Jules, I'm so sorry. Jules."
The wall that usually hid the truth deep in his eyes had crumbled. She could see the panic there, the desperation, the relief that had punched through his defenses. He was still holding her wrist. She didn't know if she leaned into him first or if he pulled her toward him. Maybe both. They crashed together like stars colliding, and then he was kissing her.
Jules. Julian. Kissing her.
His mouth moved against hers, hot and restless, turning her body to liquid fire. She clawed at his back, pulling him closer. His clothes were wet, but his skin under them was hot wherever she could touch it. When she placed her hands on his waist, he gasped into her mouth, a gasp that was half incredulity and half desire.
"Emma," he said,
a word halfway between a prayer and a groan. His mouth was wild on hers. They were kissing as if they were trying to tear down the bars that held them inside a prison, as if they were both drowning and they could breathe only through each other. Her bones felt as if they had turned to glass. They seemed to be shattering all through her body. She crumpled backward, pulling Julian with her, letting the weight of his body push them both down into the sand. She clutched at his shoulders, thought of the disoriented moment when he'd pulled her out of the water, the moment she hadn't quite known who he was. He was stronger, bigger than she remembered. More grown up than she had let herself know, though every kiss was burning away her memories of the boy he had been. When he leaned closer into her, she jumped in surprise at the wet coldness of his shirt. He reached down and grasped the collar, tearing it over his head. When he leaned back down on her, the expanse of his bare skin stunned her, and her hands slid up his sides, over the wings of his shoulder blades, as if she were articulating the shape of him, creating him with a touch of her palms and fingers. The light scars of his old marks,
the heat of his skin, filmed with salty ocean water, the feel of his smooth sea-glass bracelet. He took her breath away with the Julianness of him. There was no one else he could be. She knew him by touch, by the way he breathed, by the beat of his heart against hers. The touch of her hands was undoing him. She could see him unraveling piece by piece. Her knees came up to clasp his hips. Her hand cupped the bare skin above the waistband of his jeans, gently as the ocean at low tide, and he shuddered against her as if he were dying. She had never seen him like this, not even when he was painting. Gasping, he tore his mouth away from hers, forcing himself still, forcing his body to stop moving. She could see what it cost him in his eyes, black with hunger and impatience, in the way that when he drew his hands away, they dug into the sand on either side of her, fingers clawing into the ground. "Emma," he whispered, "you're sure?" She nodded and reached for him. He made a sound of desperate relief and gratitude and caught her against him, and this time there was no hesitation. Her arms were open. He went into them and gathered her up against him, shivering down to his bones as she locked her ankles behind his calves, pinning him against her, as she opened herself, making her body a cradle for him to lie against. He found her mouth with his again, and as if her lips were connected to every nerve ending in her body, her whole self seemed to spark and dance. So this was what it was supposed to be like, what kissing was supposed to be like, what all of it was supposed to be like. This. He leaned in to outline her mouth, her cheek, the sandy curve of her jaw with kisses. He kissed his way down her throat, his breath warm on her skin, tangling her hands in his wet curls. She stared up in wonder at the sky above them, wheeling with stars, shimmering and cold, and thought that this couldn't be happening. People didn't get things they wanted like this. "Jules," she whispered, "my Julian." "Always," he whispered, returning to her mouth. "Always." And they fell into each other with the inevitability of a wave crashing against the beach. Fire raced up and down Emma's veins as the barriers between them vanished. She tried to press each moment, each gesture into her memory. The feel of his hands closing on her shoulders, the drowning gasp he made, the way he dissolved into her as he lost himself. To the last moment of her life, she thought, she would recall the way he buried his face against her neck and said her name over and over, as if every other word had been forgotten forever in the depths of the ocean. To the last hour. When the stars stopped spinning, Emma was lying in the curve of Julian's arm, looking up. His dry flannel jacket was spread over them. He was gazing at her, head propped up on one hand. He looked dazed, his eyes half-lidded. His fingers traced slow circles on her bare shoulder. His heart was still racing, slamming against hers. She loved him so much it felt like her chest was cracking open. She wanted to tell him so, but the words stuck in her throat. "Was that," she began, "was that your first kiss?" "No, I've been practicing on random strangers." He grinned, wild and beautiful in the moonlight. "Yes, that was my first kiss." A shiver went through Emma. She thought, "I love you, Julian Blackthorne. I love you more than starlight." "It really wasn't that bad," she said and smiled at him. He laughed and pulled her closer against him. She relaxed into the curve of his body. The air was cold, but she was warm here in this small circle with Julian, hidden by the outcroppings of rock, wrapped in the flannel jacket that smelled like him. His hand was gentle in her hair. "Shh, Emma, go to sleep." She closed her eyes. Emma slept by the side of the ocean, and she had no nightmares. "Emma." There was a hand on her shoulder shaking her. "Emma, wake up." She rolled over and blinked, then froze in surprise. There was no ceiling over her, only bright blue sky. She felt stiff and sore, her skin abraded by sand. Julian was hovering over her. He was fully dressed, his face gray-white like scattered ash. His hands fluttered around her, not quite touching her, like Ty's butterflies. Someone was here. At that, she did sit up. She was sitting on the beach, a small bare half-circle of a beach, hemmed in on either side by fingers of stone reaching into the ocean. The sand around her was thoroughly churned up, and she blushed, memory crashing into her like a wave. It looked like it was at least midday, though thankfully the beach was deserted. It was familiar, too. They were close to the Institute, closer than she'd thought. Not that she'd thought much. She dragged air into her lungs. "Oh," she said. "Oh, my God." Julian didn't say anything. His clothes were wet, crusted with sand where they folded. Her own clothes were on, Emma realized belatedly. Julian must have dressed her. Only her feet were bare. The tide was low, seaweed lying exposed at the waterline. Their footsteps from the night before had long been washed away, but there were other footsteps embedded in the sand. It looked as if someone had climbed over one of the rock walls, walked up to them, and then doubled back and walked away. Two lines of footsteps. Emma stared at them in horror.
"Someone saw us," she said.
"While we were sleeping," said Julian. "I didn't wake up either." His hands knotted at his sides. "Some mundane, I hope, just figuring we were a dumb teenage couple." He let out a breath. "I hope," he said again. Flashes of memory of the night before shot through Emma's mind. The cold water, the demons, Julian carrying her, Julian kissing her, Julian and her lying entwined on the sand. Julian. She didn't think she could think of him as Jules again. Jules was her childhood name for him, and they had left their childhood behind. He turned to look at her, and she saw the anguish in his sea-colored eyes. "I'm so sorry," he whispered. "Emma, I'm so, so sorry." "Why are you sorry?" she asked. "I didn't think." He was pacing, his feet kicking up sand. "About being safe. Protection. I didn't think about it." "I'm protected," she said. He whirled to face her. "What?" "I have the rune," she said. "And I don't have any diseases, and neither do you." "Do you?" "I... no." The relief on his face was palpable and for some reason made her stomach ache. "That was my first time, Emma."
"I know," she said in a whisper. "Anyway, you don't need to apologize."
"I do," he said. "I mean, this is good. We're lucky. But I should have thought of it. I don't have an excuse. I was out of my mind." She opened her mouth and closed it again. "I must have been, to do that," he said.
"To do what?"
She was impressed by how clearly and calmly each word came out. Anxiety beat through her like a drum.
"What we did," he exhaled.
"You know what I mean. You're saying what we did was wrong." "I meant..." He looked as if he were trying to contain something that wanted to tear its way out of him. "There's nothing wrong with it, morally," he said. "It's a stupid law. But it is a law, and we can't break it. It's one of the oldest laws there is."
"But it doesn't make sense."
He looked at her without seeing her, blindly. "The law is hard, but it is the law." Emma got to her feet. "No," she said, "no law can control our feelings."
"I didn't say anything about feelings," said Julian.
Her throat felt dry.
"What do you mean?"
"We shouldn't have slept together," he said. "I know it meant something to me. I'd be lying if I said it didn't. But the law doesn't forbid sex. It forbids love. Being in love."
"I'm pretty sure sleeping together is against the rules, too."
"Yeah, but it's not what they exile you for. It's not what they strip your marks for." He raked a hand through his snarled hair. "It's against the rules because being intimate like that, physically intimate, it opens you up to being emotionally intimate, and that's what they care about."
"We are emotionally intimate."
"You know what I mean. Don't pretend you don't. There are different kinds of closeness, intimacy. They want us to be close, but they don't want this."
He gestured around at the beach as if to encompass all of the night before. Emma was shaking.
"Eros," she said, "instead of philia or agape."
He looked relieved, as if her explanation meant she understood. She agreed, as if they had made some decision together. Emma wanted to scream.
"Philia," he said. "That's what we have. Friendship love. And I'm sorry if I did anything to screw that up."
"I was there too," Emma said, and her voice was as cold as the water. He looked at her levelly.
"We love each other," he said. "We're parabatai. Love is part of the bond, and I'm attracted to you. How could I not be? You're beautiful. And it's not like..." He broke off,
but Emma filled the rest in for him. The words so painful they almost seemed to cut at the inside of her head.
"It's not like I can meet other girls, not like I can date. You're what there is. You're what's around. Christina's probably still in love with someone in Mexico. There isn't anyone for me. There's just you."
"It's not like I'm blind," he said. "I can see you, and I want you, but we can't. If we do, we'll end up falling in love, and that would be a disaster."
"Falling in love," Emma echoed.
How could he not see she was already fallen in every way you could be?
Didn't I tell you I loved you last night?
He shook his head.
We never said we loved each other, he said. Not once.
That couldn't be true. Emma searched her memories as if she were rummaging desperately through her pockets for a lost key. She'd thought it. Julian Blackthorne, I love you more than Starlight. She'd thought it, but she hadn't said it, and neither had he.
We're bound together, he'd said.
But not, I love you.
She waited for him to say, I was out of my mind because you risked your life, or you almost died and it made me crazy, or any variety of it was your fault. She thought that if he did, she would blow up like an activated landmine. But he didn't. He stood looking at her, his flannel jacket shoved up to his elbows, his exposed bare skin red from cold water and scratched with sand. She had never seen him look so sad. She lifted her chin.
You're right. It's better if we forget it.
He winced at that.
I do love you, Emma.
She rubbed her hands together for warmth, thought of the way the ocean wore down even stone walls over the years, wringing fragments out of what had once been impregnable.
I know, she said, just not like that.
The first thing Emma saw when they returned to the Institute, having told Julian the story of her experience at the Convergence on their way back from the beach, was that the car she had left at the cave entrance the night before was parked at the foot of the front steps. The second was that Diana was sitting on the car's hood, looking madder than a hornet.
What were you thinking? She demanded as Emma and Julian stopped dead in their tracks. Seriously, Emma, have you lost your mind?
For a moment, Emma felt actually dizzy. Diana couldn't be talking about her and Julian, could she? She wasn't the one who'd found them on the beach. She glanced sideways at Julian, but he was as white-faced with shock as she felt. Diana's dark eyes bored into her.
I'm waiting for an explanation, she said. What made you think it was a good idea to go to the Convergence by yourselves?
Emma was too surprised to formulate a comeback.
What?
Diana's eyes flicked from Julian to Emma and back again.
I didn't get the message about the Convergence until this morning, she said. I raced over there and found the car, empty, abandoned. I thought... You don't know what I thought, but...
Emma felt a stab of guilt. Diana had been worried about her, and about Julian, who had never even gone to the Convergence.
I'm sorry... Emma said, meaning it.
Her conviction of the night before, her resolve that she was doing the right thing and going to the Convergence, had evaporated.
She felt weary now, and no closer to an answer. I got the message and just went. I didn't want to wait. And please don't be angry at Julian. He wasn't with me. He found me later.
Found you? Diana looked puzzled.
Found you where?
On the beach, said Emma. There are doorways in the cave, sort of portals. And one of them empties right out into the ocean. Now Diana's expression was truly concerned.
Emma, you ended up in the water?
But you hate the ocean. How did you?
Julian came and pulled me out, said Emma. He felt me panicking in the water. Parvati thing.
She glanced sideways at Julian, whose gaze was clear and open, trustworthy, not hiding anything.
It took us a long time to walk back.
Well... Finding the seawater is interesting, said Diana, sliding off the car's hood. I assume it's the same water found with the bodies.
How did you get the car back? Emma asked as they started up the stairs.
What you mean, of course, is thank you, Diana, for bringing the car back, Diana said as they came inside the Institute.
She glanced critically up and down Julian's and Emma's wet, sandy clothes, scraped skin, and matted hair.
How about I gather everyone in the library? It's past time for an information exchange.
Julian cleared his throat.
Why didn't you?
Diana and Emma both looked at him in puzzlement.
Why didn't who, what? Diana asked finally. Why didn't you get the message about the Convergence until this morning?
My phone was dead, which was stupid of me, but what about you?
Nothing you need concern yourself with, Diana said shortly. Anyway, go shower. I get that you have important information, but until you clean off the sand, I don't think I could concentrate on anything but how badly you two must itch.
Emma meant to change when she got back to her room. She genuinely did. But despite her hours of sleep on the beach, she was exhausted enough that the moment she sat down on the bed, she collapsed. Hours later, after a fast shower, she threw on clean jeans and a tank top and raced out into the hallway, feeling like a mundane teenager late for class.
She flew down the hall to the library to find everyone else already there. In fact, they looked as if they'd been there for a while. Ty was sitting at one end of the longest library table in a pool of afternoon sunshine, a pile of papers in front of him. Mark was by his side. Livy was balanced on top of the table, barefoot, dancing back and forth with her saber. Diana and Drew were amusing Tavi with a book.
"Diana said you went to the Convergence," said Livy, waving her saber as Emma came in.
Christina, who had been standing by a shelf of books, gave her an uncharacteristically cool look.
"Fighting mantids without me?" Mark said and smiled.
"Hardly fair."
"There weren't any mantids," said Emma.
She hopped up onto the table across from Ty, who was still scribbling, and launched into the story of what she had found in the cave. Halfway through her recitation, Julian came in, his hair as damp as Emma's. He was wearing a jade-colored T-shirt that turned his eyes dark green. Their eyes met, and Emma forgot what she was saying.
"Emma," Christina prompted after a long pause, "you were saying you found a dress?"
"This doesn't sound very likely," said Livy. "Who keeps a dress in a cave?"
"It might have been a ceremonial outfit," Emma said. "It was an elaborate robe and very elaborate jewels."
"So maybe the necromancer is a woman," said Christina.
"Maybe it really is Belinda."
"She didn't strike me as that powerful," said Mark.
"You can sense power?" asked Emma. "Is that a fairy thing?"
Mark shook his head, but the half-smile he gave felt to Emma like a sliver of fairy.
"Just a feeling."
"But speaking of fairy things, Mark did give us the key to translate more of the markings," said Livy.
"Really?" said Emma. "What do they say?"
Ty looked up from the papers. "He gave us the second line, and after that it was easier. Livy and I worked out most of the third. From looking at the patterns of the markings, it seems to be about 5 or 6 lines, repeated."
"Is it a spell?" Emma said.
"Malcolm said it was probably a summoning spell."
Ty rubbed at his face, leaving a smear of ink across one cheekbone.
"It doesn't look like a summoning spell. Maybe Malcolm made a mistake. We've done a lot better than him on the translation," he added proudly as Livy put her saber away and crouched down on the table beside him.
She reached out to rub the ink from his cheek with her sleeve. "Malcolm doesn't have Mark," said Julian, and Mark gave Julian a quick surprised smile of gratitude.
"Or Christina," said Mark. "I would never have figured out the connection if Christina had not realized it was an issue of translation."
Christina blushed.
"So how does the third line go, Tiberius?"
Ty batted Livy's hand away and recited, "First the flame, and then the flood. In the end, it's blackthorn blood. Seek thou to forget what's past."
"That's it," he finished. "That's what we have so far."
"Blackthorn blood," echoed Diana. She had climbed up onto a library ladder to hand a book down to Tavi. Emma frowned.
"I don't really love the sound of that."
"There's no indication of traditional blood magic," said Julian. "None of the bodies had those kinds of cuts or wounds."
"I wonder about the mention of the past," said Mark. "These kind of rhymes in fairy often encode a spell, like the ballad of Thomas the Rhymer. It is both a story and instructions on how to break someone free of fairy."
For a moment, Diana's face was arrested mid-expression, as if she had either suddenly realized or suddenly remembered something.
"Diana," Julian said, "are you okay?"
"Fine." She climbed down from the ladder and dusted off her clothes. "I need to make a call."
"Who are you calling?" Julian asked, but Diana only shook her head, her hair brushing her shoulders.
"I'll be back," she said, and slipped out the library door.
"But what does it mean?" Emma said to the room at large.
"In the end, blackthorn blood what?"
"And if it's a fairy rhyme, then shouldn't they know if there's more of it?" Drew spoke up from the corner where she was busy distracting Tavi.
"The fair folk, I mean. They're meant to be on our side for this."
"I have sent a message," Mark said guardedly. "But I will tell you, I only ever heard those 2 lines of it. The most significant thing it means is that somehow the situation, the murders, the bodies, the followers, is tied to this family." Julian looked around.
"Somehow it's connected to us, to the Blackthorns."
"That would explain why all this is happening in Los Angeles," said Mark. "It is our home." Emma saw Julian's expression flicker slightly and knew what he was thinking. That Mark had spoken of Los Angeles as a place they all lived, not a place where everyone lived but him. That he had spoken of it as home. There was a loud buzzing sound. The map of Los Angeles on the table had started to vibrate. What looked like a small red dot was moving across it.
"Sterling's left his house," Christina said, reaching for the map.
"Belinda Bell said he had 2 days," said Julian.
"That could mean the hunt starts tomorrow,
or it could mean tonight, depending on how they're counting. Anyway, we can't assume."
"Christina and I will follow him," Emma said. She was desperate to get out of the house suddenly, desperate to clear her head, desperate even to get away from Julian.
Mark frowned.
"We should go with you."
"No," Emma said, hopping down from the table. Everyone turned to look at her in surprise. She had spoken with more force than she meant to. The truth was, she wanted to talk to Christina alone.
"We're going to have to take it in shifts," she said. "We're going to have to tail Sterling 24/7 until something happens, and if we all go every time, we'll just end up with everyone exhausted. Christina and I will go for a while, and then we can switch off with Julian and Mark, or Diana."
"Or me and Ty," suggested Livy sweetly. Julian's eyes were troubled.
"Emma, are you sure?"
"Emma's right," Christina said unexpectedly. "Taking shifts is the cautious thing to do."
Cautious. Emma couldn't remember that word being applied to her in recent history.
Julian glanced away, hiding his expression.
At last, he said,
"Fine, you win. You two go. But if you need any backup, swear that you'll call right away." His gaze locked with Emma's as he spoke. The others were talking, discussing how they should search the library, look back through the books detailing different kinds of spells, how long it would take to finish the rest of the translation, whether Malcolm might come to help them, whether they should order vampire pizza.
"Come on, Emma," said Christina, rising to her feet and folding the map into her jacket pocket.
"We should get going. We need to change into gear and catch up to Sterling. He's heading toward the freeway." Emma nodded and turned to follow Christina. She could feel Julian's gaze on her, like a sharp point between her shoulder blades.
"Don't turn back to look at him," she told herself.
But she couldn't help it. At the door, she turned, and the look on his face almost undid her. He looked like she felt, hollow and bled dry. It wasn't that she was walking away from the boy she loved with 1,000 words unsaid between them, Emma thought, though it was true that she was doing that. It was that she was terrified that a rift had opened between her and the person who had been her best friend as long as she could remember. And from the look of it, Julian was afraid of the same thing.
"Sorry," Emma said as the car righted itself. They'd been driving around for several hours as Sterling hurtled all over the city, and her hands were starting to ache from gripping the wheel.
Christina sighed.
"Are you going to tell me what's bothering you?"
Emma shifted. She was wearing her gear jacket, and it was hot in the car. She felt as if all her skin was itching.
"I'm really, really sorry, Tina," she said. "I didn't think... I shouldn't have asked you to cover up for me when I went to the Convergence. It wasn't fair."
Christina was silent for a moment.
"I would have done it," she said, "if you told me what it was about."
Emma's throat felt tight.
"I'm not used to trusting people, but I should have trusted you. When you leave, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to miss you so much."
Christina smiled at her.
"Come to the DF," she said. "See how we do things there. You can take your travel year in my city," she paused.
"I forgive you, by the way." A small weight lifted from Emma's chest.
"I'd love to go to Mexico," she said, "and Julian would..."
She broke off. Of course, most people with parabatai accompanied them on their travel year. But the thought of Julian hurt, a sharp, quick pain like a needle stick.
"Are you going to tell me what's bothering you?" Christina asked.
"No," Emma said.
"Fine.
Then turn left on Entrada," Christina said.
"It's like having supernatural GPS," Emma observed. She could see Christina scowling at the map across her knees in the passenger seat.
"We head toward Santa Monica," Christina said, tracing a finger along the map. "Go down 7th.
"Sterling's an idiot," Emma said. "He knows someone's trying to kill him. He shouldn't be wandering around the city."
"He probably thinks his own house isn't that safe," Christina pointed out reasonably. "I mean, I ambushed him there."
"Right," Emma said.
She couldn't stop worrying a rip in the knee of her gear. The memory of Julian on the beach, the things he had said to her, pressed against the backs of her eyes. She let the thoughts pass through her. When it came time, she'd have to let them all go and concentrate on the fight.
"And of course, there are the enormous bunny rabbits," Christina said.
"What?" Emma snapped back to the present.
"I've been talking at you for the last 3 minutes. Where is your mind, Emma?"
"I slept with Julian," Emma said.
Christina shrieked. Then she clapped her hands over her mouth and stared at Emma as if Emma had just announced there was a grenade strapped to the roof of the car and about to explode.
"Did you hear what I said?" Emma asked. Yes, Christina said, taking her hands away from her mouth. You slept with Julian Blackthorn.
Emma's breath whooshed out of her in a rush. There was something about hearing it said back to her that made her feel as if she'd been gut-punched.
I thought you weren't going to tell me what was wrong, Christina said.
I changed my mind.
Why?
They were whipping around corners lined with palm trees, stucco houses set back from the streets. Emma knew she was driving too fast. She didn't care. I mean, I was in the ocean, and he pulled me out, and things got out of hand.
No, Christina said. Not why did you do it? Why did you change your mind about telling me?
Because I'm a horrible liar, Emma said. You would have guessed.
Maybe, maybe not.
Christina took a deep breath.
I suppose I should ask the real question. Do you love him?
Emma didn't say anything. She kept her eyes on the broken yellow line in the middle of the road. The sun was a fiery orange ball lowering in the west. Christina exhaled slowly.
You do love him.
I didn't say that.
It's all over your face, Christina said.
I know what that looks like.
She sounded sad.
Don't pity me, Tina, Emma said. Please don't.
I'm just frightened for you. The law is very clear and the punishments are so severe.
Well, it doesn't matter, said Emma, her voice tinged with bitterness. He doesn't love me. And being unrequitedly in love with your parabatai isn't illegal, so don't worry.
He what?
Christina said, sounding shocked.
He doesn't love me, said Emma. He was very clear about that.
Christina opened her mouth and then closed it again. I guess it's flattering that you're surprised, Emma said.
I don't know what to say.
Christina put her hand over her heart. There are the things you would normally say in this situation.
If it was anyone else but Julian, I'd be telling you how lucky he was to have someone as brave and smart as you are in love with him.
I would be scheming with you about how we could make such a silly boy realize such an obvious thing.
But it is Julian, and it is illegal. And you must not do anything more, Emma. Promise me.
He doesn't want me that way, Emma said. So it doesn't matter. I just... She broke off. She didn't know what else to say or how to say it. There was never going to be another Julian for her.
Don't think that way. Just because you can't imagine loving anyone else doesn't mean that you won't.
But the soft inner voice of her father didn't reassure her this time.
I just don't know why it's illegal, she finished, though that had not been what she had meant to say. It doesn't make any sense.
Julian and I have done everything together for years. We've lived and nearly died for each other. How could there be anyone else better for me than him?
Anyone else better?
She broke off again.
Emma, please don't think like this. It doesn't matter why it's illegal. It just matters that it is. The law is hard, but it is the law.
A bad law is no law, Emma countered, swinging a hard right onto Pico Boulevard. Pico ran almost the full length of metropolitan Los Angeles. It was swanky, gritty, dangerous, abandoned, and industrial by turns. Here, between the freeway and the ocean, it was full of small businesses and restaurants. That motto has not served the Blackthorns well, Christina murmured. And Emma was about to ask her what she meant when Christina sat up straight.
Here, she said, pointing. Sterling's here. I just saw him go into that building.
On the south side of the road was a low, sloping, brown-painted building, windowless, with a single door and a sign proclaiming, "No one under 21 allowed." "Looks friendly," Emma muttered and pulled over to park. They got out of the car and went to collect their weapons. They already bore glamour runes, and the few pedestrians passing by, hardly anyone walked in L.A., and while there were plenty of cars around, there were very few people, looked through them as if they weren't there. A girl with bright green hair glanced at Emma as she passed by, but didn't stop. "You're right," Emma said as they buckled on their serif blades. Each blade had a small hook that allowed it to be affixed to a weapons belt and removed with a quick downward jerk of the hand. "About Julian. I know you are." Christina gave her a quick one-armed hug.
"And you will do the right thing. I know you will."
Emma was already scanning the building, looking for entrances. There were no windows that she could see, but a narrow alley snaked around the back of the bar, partially blocked by an overgrown patch of needle grass. She gestured toward it, and she and Christina slipped silently through the low, dusty vegetation that grew, barely, in the polluted air. The sun was setting,
and it was dark in the alley behind the bar. A row of chained-together trash cans were propped under a barred and boarded-up window.
"I can get the bars off if I climb up there," Emma whispered, indicating the trash cans.
"Okay, wait." Christina pulled out her steely. "Runes." Christina's runes were careful, precise, and beautiful. Emma could feel the power of a strength rune jolt through her like a kick of caffeine. It wasn't like having Julian put runes on her. That felt as if his strength were flowing into her, doubling her own. Christina turned around, shrugging her jacket down, presenting the line of her bare shoulder to Emma. She handed the steely to Emma, who began to draw. Two overlapping soundless runes, sure strike, flexibility.
"Please don't think I'm angry," Christina said, facing the opposite wall. "I worry for you is all."
"You are so strong, Emma. You are strong down to your bones. People live through heartbreak, and you are strong enough to live through it many times. But Julian is not someone who can just touch your heart. He can touch your soul, and there is a difference between having your heart break and having your soul shatter."
The steely faltered in Emma's hand.
"I thought the angel had a plan."
"He does. But please don't love him, Emma." Christina's voice broke. "Please."
There was a catch in Emma's throat when she spoke.
"Who broke your heart?"
Christina turned around, shrugging her jacket back on. Her brown eyes were serious.
"You told me a secret, so I will tell you a secret. I was in love with Diego, and I thought he was in love with me. But it was all a lie. I thought his brother was my best friend, but that was a lie, too. That is why I ran away, why I came here."
She looked away.
"I lost them both, my best friend and my best love, on the same day. It was hard for me to believe that Raziel had a plan then. My best friend and my best love."
Christina took the steely and slid it back into her belt.
"I'm not the one who's strong, Tina. That's you."
Christina gave her a quick smile and held out her hand.
"Go."
Grabbing Christina's hand, Emma pushed off to propel herself upward. Her boots hit the top of the trash cans, making the chain rattle. She grabbed the bars of the window and pulled, liking the bite of the metal into her palms. The bars pulled free of the soft stucco with a shower of tiny pebbles. Emma handed the metal grid down, and Christina tossed it into the grass. Emma reached a hand down, and a second later Christina was beside her, and they were both peering into a smudged window at a dirty back kitchen. Water was running in a massive metal sink full of glasses. Emma drew her foot back, ready to smash the glass with the steel tip of her boot. Christina caught her shoulder.
"Wait."
She bent down and grabbed the window by its frame. The strength rune on her neck buckled and glowed as she wrenched the rotted frame free and dropped it onto the plastic trash cans below.
"Quieter that way," she said.
Emma grinned and swung in through the window, landing on top of a crate full of vodka bottles. She sprang down and Christina followed her. Christina's boots hit the floor just as the kitchen door swung open and a short man in a bartender's apron with spiked black hair came into the room. The moment he caught sight of Emma and Christina, he let out a startled yelp. "Great," Emma thought, "he had the sight." "Hello there," she said. "We're from the Department of Health. Did you know that there is no antibacterial hand gel left in these dispensers?" This did not seem to impress the bartender. His gaze went from Emma to Christina to the open window. "What the hell are you bitches doing breaking in here? I'm going to call the..." Emma picked up a wooden spoon from the draining board and threw it. It thunked into the side of the bartender's head. He went down in a heap. She strolled over and checked his pulse. It was regular. She glanced up at Christina. "I hate being called a bitch." Christina moved past her and pushed the door open, peeking out, while Emma dragged the bartender into the corner of the room and pushed him gently behind the stacked crates of bottles. Christina wrinkled up her nose. "Yuck." Emma let go of the bartender's feet. They thumped to the ground.
"What? Something horrible happening out there?"
"No, it's just a really disgusting bar," Christina said. "Why would anyone want to drink here?" Emma joined her at the door and they both peered out. "Bars in the DF are much nicer," Christina said. "I think someone has thrown up in that corner." She pointed. Emma didn't look, but she believed it. The bar wasn't just dimly lit, it was barely lit. The floor was concrete, strewn with cigarette butts. There was a zinc-countered bar and a mirror behind it on which drink prices had been scrawled in marker. Men in flannel shirts and jeans crowded around a ragged felt pool table. Others stood silently drinking at the bar. The place smelled like sour, old beer and cigarette smoke. Hunched at the far end of the bar was a man in a familiar herringbone jacket. Sterling.
"There he is," said Emma.
The tracking rune doesn't lie. Christina ducked under Emma's arm and stepped into the room. Emma followed. She felt a slight pressure on her skin that came with